And we are recording.
And we got three hot mics. You know what that means.
That means we get to be educated and entertained at the same time. Was that edutainment? Isn't that what they call it?
Edutainment. Yeah, I guess.
So who's going to be edutaining us today? Is that the right way to say it? I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Who is this third mic? Who are you, third mic?
Third mic? I'm Jory Scott.
Well, hey, Jory.
Hello.
How's it going, man?
It's awesome.
Thank you for getting behind the microphone and edutaining us today.
I never edutained anybody.
So, this is, again, one of those opportunities where I have inside information. So I have so many things I want to ask you about. Because you do some cool stuff. You do some really unique stuff. Not even for Mississippi, but like for the country, unique stuff. So
kinda.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to pull as much out of it as I can. But before that, we are going to treat you to a beverage. And Caleb, are you going to educate this guy on it at all? Or is it
nope. Just give her a rip. This is a new drink. We actually just launched it this past week.
So it's a menu item.
It's an actual menu item that we just launched. And yeah, let's get your feedback.
Is this a Sunday morning drink or a Sunday afternoon drink?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a liquor license yet, but it does kind of look like
Caleb,
something.
Caleb, he drove to this interview.
It would probably pair very well with some vodka.
It would. It is very good.
Ooh. I like this, sir.
Citrusy, sugary Sunday afternoon drink.
Now, something that we like to do is we try to figure out what's in it. All right, so what? Take a stab first, sir. What do you think, Corey?
Me?
Yeah. What do you think's in this cup?
Habanero.
No, that'd be an interesting thing to pair with.
I think this is a lemonade.
It is.
But you got other stuff going on though.
Well, this is what's called a loaded lemonade.
Loaded lemonade.
Loaded
okay.
lemonade.
But loaded lemonade. So obviously the loaded tea craze that's out there. We don't do a loaded tea. You've heard of us talk about our cafe sliders, which have all the vitamins. So this is a lemonade that's actually loaded with caffeine. It's got 160 milligrams of caffeine, complex B vitamins.
So I need to go preach at the church after drinking this.
That's right.
But turns out you have no problem driving home at all now.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, yeah, we're just launching. It may not be the best. This is obviously probably more of a refreshing summer spring drink, but we decided to go ahead and launch it in the fall. That way we can get some traction going into next spring.
So if I get a ticket driving home, can I blame
you're good.
This?
You're good. Yeah, you're good. You might be talking a little fast, but
so
a little bit.
How does the whole fortification work? Like do you dump straight caffeine into this thing, or like how does that work?
Yeah, so there's a company named Lotus that makes a concentrate, and so it actually comes. So the caffeine comes from a condensed Arabica coffee bean and a green tea extract.
Would that be a natural caffeine?
Yeah, it is a natural caffeine. So
that means your body doesn't acclimate to it.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I just know it makes me feel good.
Just go
with
it.
You tell me.
You didn't say it. I did.
we'll go off of you. Maybe you need to write my marketing literature. That way I've got some plausible deniability.
We're going to go over the line if we do that.
Anyway, I think we've tested the concoction for the past couple of weeks to try to get it right. I think we got it.
It's right, really good.
Right where we need it to be.
And yeah, I feel like I can't even give you a hard time about it. It is good. I mean, I will give you a hard time about the fact that you said you're rolling out a spring drink in September. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Well, it is fall season, and so fair people going to fairs, and people are going to be kind of used to getting the fresh squeezed lemonade.
Do we really have a fall here?
Touche.
Well, I mean, really.
But I've also noticed that it just when we come, obviously, you know, we don't have the power of a large chain, and so it takes some time for something to get traction on new drinks. And so
on everything.
And so I was like, well, if we go ahead and launch it now and start getting maybe some traction on it, I think we'll be in a healthy place by the time spring rolls around. So
now, Jory,
you can drink lemonade all year round.
Heck, hey, yeah, man.
It's like coffee.
And so, Jory, you one of those kind of guys, like, can you have caffeine later in the day and you're good still or what?
Probably not.
Sorry.
I'm going to call you at 2 a.m.
You may be up a little bit.
I'll be talking a little fast. I'm gonna say, now, what did you mean when you asked me that question?
So I'm that guy. For me, it's about 7 p.m. cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I make the mistake of doing caffeine after 7 p.m., it's a bad night.
I used to be about 2:30. And I really don't know anymore, to be honest. Yeah, about 2:30. I'd be up all night. But I do think that's changed.
Because, you know, you hear some people talk about how they can drink it before they go to bed. I don't know how.
My daughter can take anything. I mean, anything. And Claritin D. When she's going to bed and go and sleep till 10 tomorrow.
My wife and I will drink a pot of coffee and go right to sleep.
That is a pot of coffee.
You know, the big 32-ounce Red Bulls. I'll drink one of those right before bed.
Right before bed.
I'll go right to sleep.
You going to dream about running or something?
No.
Oh, man.
Sure.
I'd have some crazy dreams if I did fall asleep. They would be bad. Yeah.
You'll be coming up with these concoctions in your dream. Wake up with a whole new menu.
I do dream about menus. So,
I knew it.
And it's usually what not to do.
I knew it.
But
how's that for commitment?
Enough about me.
Yeah, tell us about Jory. And I think probably the best way to do it, how about like a chronological summary, maybe, you know, Jory starting out, college age, you know, what'd you start doing? Take us back there.
College age, right out of high school, I really didn't do a lot of college. I took night classes, and then I ended up being a professional bullfighter. I was top 6 in the nation, all over the Southeast and some of the Midwest.
Bullfight. So are you talking about like were they riding, but like PBR? Okay, mm-hmm. Cool.
Yep. And used to we did actually freestyle bullfighting.
Yeah. What does that mean?
So that's where they turn a bull loose that you freestyling by yourself out there and you get scored for
it. So you know, like Mike White, Corey McFadden. Mm-hmm. I went to school with those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. He won the national finals in bull riding.
Yep. White did.
Late 90s, early 2000s. Yep. Anyway, good dude.
Yep.
Him and that. Shout out Mike White and Hannah in Louisiana.
So you said you won how many times?
Oh, I don't know how many times I won. I was ranked top 6.
Top 6 in the nation.
Yeah.
For bull riding.
Yeah, bullfighting.
Bullfighting.
Okay. Yeah. And
so you're the guys that really that like your main role, would you say your main is protecting that rider?
Yeah. I really didn't like bullfighting. Yeah. I was forced to do it because I was good at it. They wouldn't hire me unless I would get into the freestyle bullfighting. And the more you win, the more that's what the contractors want.
Right.
And so
that's brings
the
money.
Yeah. And I was all about the protection. Yeah. And they wanted us to do the freestyle. So we would do it. And it just got to the point I got tired of it and just said, hey, if you want me to work, I'll work, but I'm not doing any more freestyle.
So how often would you say you've had to step in and really protect? Is it pretty much every single rodeo that you've ever worked?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. How important they are.
Yeah, but back then it was different because the bulls were mean and they were hooking. And so you had a bull rider on his back and the bull's trying to get him off where you can hook him and you're trying to get his head up.
Well, you telling me there's some DEI in the bull?
I'm afraid there is.
Softer bulls?
Yes. See, what happened, the PBR came along and they changed it.
They changed the rules?
Well, yeah, because used to, you just put your name in the hat and you drew what you drew. Allegedly. You know, if you had a top-end bull rider in an event, he wasn't going to draw a bad bull. Just let's just say it that way. But in the PBR, the higher you rank, they choose which bulls they want all the way down to the last guy. The last, the lowest ranked guy at the event gets the bull that's left. So the top bull rider can pick the bull that he knows he can ride and get a decent score on, and it goes down the line. Well, what happened is they just over time started voting out these bulls or not selecting these bulls that were mean.
Interesting.
And so it's genetically just moved it to where over the last 25 years that the mean bulls really aren't in there anymore.
It's all got all these soft bulls.
Yeah, softies. What's that? You know? And so, yeah, it, when we were doing it, the bulls.
Do the bulls now know that they're bulls?
I don't know. You know, I mean, there's some trainees. You know, it is interesting that, you know, when we were freestyling, you had American bulls and Mexican bulls, and they fought completely different.
Really?
Yeah, American bulls, very intelligent. He comes at you switching his leads, trying to confuse you. A Mexican bull just comes at you wide open. And they'll spin in front of the Mexican bull, and he won't hook them because he'll stop and get mesmerized by the spinning. American bulls don't do that. American bulls will run through it. And so when they come at you, they would switch their leads, turn their head one way and switch the lead to the other, trying to get you to commit to a side that they could catch
What's
you on.
What's the deal with the color red and bulls?
I think it's just a bright color.
Okay.
You know, they always say a bull sees red. Okay. He really sees movement.
Okay.
You know, but that was just how it was different then than it is now. And now you got the grounds harder. You know, the arenas are packed where the clay in the arena is real hard. It's almost as hard as this right here. Used to, it was deeper sand. Well, it was harder for a good bull to buck hard, but yet when the rider hit the ground, it wasn't like hitting a piece of concrete.
Right.
Oh, well, now it's changed. So now they want the ground clay and hard so the bull can buck harder, makes a better show. But when the rider hits the ground, it's like hitting concrete.
They wear a lot more protective
gear. They wear a lot more protective gear.
But,
and
but
a so lot
it's not
of it's
just
because
the bull,
of that.
But because of the ground. Yeah. Interesting.
Dude. And you know, when Lane Frost died 8 seconds, it changed everything because all of a sudden everybody started wearing protective vests. And I remember I was working a Gary LaFue bucking school where Gary LaFue would come in. He was a champion rider. And he would put on these bucking schools. And he comes in, his son Brett came in, and he had this vest on. And Brett said, hey, when we meet these kids, I want you to take this 2x4 that he had ground down, had a bat handle on, and I want you to hit me in the chest. I'm like, how hard? He's as hard as you can. I was like, deal. And I thought, I'm going to kill this guy in front of everybody. It's going to be legal. And he put the vest on, and I hit him so hard it knocked him over a table. And he got up and brushed off.
Wow.
And I bought that vest.
Yeah.
Wow.
I bought that vest. It was the first one I ever saw. And I'm telling you, it changed the game.
Huh.
I mean, I've had him lunge and hit me right between in the center of my chest and knock me 7 or 8 feet. And where I had drag prints and get up and brush off.
Are you serious?
Made of Kevlar?
No, it's plastic. Pure plastic.
Interesting.
Just a big sheet of 1/8-inch plastic, and it had a little padding under it.
That's it?
But when it would, you had a piece on the back and a piece on the front, and they just lapped over on the sides and Velcroed. And Velcroed front to back, back to front, and back to front. And he could hit you and knock you through that wall, as long as he didn't hit you in the head.
Protecting those internal organs. And it's like what Lane Frost, he had his lung punctured, correct?
Yeah,
the rib.
Yeah, the rib, broke a rib, and it went through his aorta.
Oh, okay.
That's he didn't even make it out of the arena.
Yeah.
He was gone in seconds.
Yeah.
But with his death came that, and it changed bull riding completely.
Jory, I have to ask, man, like the average bull that you were dealing with weighs what?
probably 1,300.
So you got 1,300 pounds of rage coming at you.
100%.
What made you decide you were going to be a bullfighter?
Girls.
I love how quickly.
That's what I'm talking about.
Quickly he said honest. That, too.
I'm married now, just full disclosure. But, yeah, I mean, you're the most well-known person in the arena.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to interact with the crowd, and you get to, you know, he's always talking about you.
You're in the action the whole time.
You're in the action the entire time. All the bull riders know you. I mean, stuff happens. You do something. I remember one day this guy fell off right in the chute, and I stepped in between him and the bull hit me, and there was a crossbar that was about 16 feet in the air. And I remember when I came up, that crossbar was right in front of me, and I looked down and realized I was going to go over into the chute, so I just pushed off the crossbar and landed right back in the footprints I came out of.
Unbelievable.
And the whole place goes nuts. The bull riders are throwing their hats out of the chutes. I mean, you know, we're all a bunch of guys. We know each other. And, you know, you were the life of the party.
Yeah.
So is it safe to assume it's just pure adrenaline?
I mean, yeah, it is for a while.
Yeah.
And then after a point, it goes away.
Really?
Yeah.
And what's it replaced with? Fear?
More respect.
Really?
You know, the best way to learn how to not get hit is get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And you just start getting more comfortable in the fact that you're going to get hit. You know, when you get past the kind of like the first hit jitters of any show, once you get hit once, it's kind of like, okay, everything's good now, because you kind of got that nervousness out of the way.
Yeah.
And after a while, it's gone. And it's more of a job. And, you know, you're just there because you're being paid to do what they want you to do. And one day you look up and you realize, you know, I can make more money doing something over there, not traveling and spending all this money. And then it's not quite as exciting anymore.
Wow.
Well, so it sounds like you've came to that realization, and then how long did you do that?
About 10 years.
Oh, wow. And so how did you transition away from that? And the reason why I'm asking this is, see, you know, so much of our, as men, our identities come from that thing that we do.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, when baseball came to an end,
it was rough.
It rattled me, even though I knew that was
part of my life. It was rough for me.
Yeah.
I was really unhappy for a year.
Really?
Really unhappy. But that's how I ended up at Hattiesburg.
Okay.
Bill Chambers was the athletic trainer for PRCA, and he had a big 18-wheeler trailer that he pulled all the events. And when you were hurt or you needed tape or you needed stretching or some type of modality, you went to Bill, and he worked on you. And one day we're sitting there talking about it, and I was working as an occupational therapy assistant. And he asked me what was I was wanting to go to physical therapy school, and they denied me because I had a 3.85 average and not a 4.0.
Are you serious?
Yes, and it really aggravated me.
So it's that competitive.
It's that competitive, and it really aggravated me. And so I was talking to Bill about it, and he said, "You live in Jackson." I said, "Yeah." He said, "The number one athletic training school in the U.S. is USM. Mm-hmm. Why don't you go there?" And I thought about it, and he said, "You get to work sports and not in nursing homes." And that did it for me.
Yeah.
So I came to USM, went and applied. I think there was 100 students applied. I think 56 of us got accepted, and 4 of us graduated.
Four.
Wow.
How was that explained? Is that intense or what?
Yeah, it was rough too, you know, but if you wanted it, you stayed.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, we would go to these events across the U.S., like CETA over in Atlanta, and everybody would say, "Oh, here comes USM guys." We'd sit up front. Everybody knew. I remember the year I graduated, there was 4 of us that graduated. There were 3 NFL jobs, and we got all 3 of them.
Okay. Wow. So, in retrospect, what made the program so nationally appreciated?
The level, I guess, of training that we got.
Huh.
And Jim Gillespie and Doc are well known all over the U.S., and Jim's still here. Probably one of the people that changed my life was Jim Gillespie, from just a goofball country boy bullfighting to a medical person that
worked hard and did everything and learned to play the role, and you didn't want, they let you know you're not going to get a bunch of high fives. Nobody knows you exist.
Yeah.
You're out here, you're part of the team, and that's the way it works. And if that's not what you want, you need to go do something else.
Did you kind of like the idea of being behind the scenes a little bit?
I liked being doing just something different.
Yeah.
You know, but the reality was, as soon as I graduated, I said, I don't want to be an athletic trainer doing athletic training.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How come?
I was getting married. My wife, Chrissy, she was pregnant with our daughter. And I just sat there and thought about it. And I said, you know, I'm never going to be at home at night. I'm never going to be at home on Saturdays. And I want to try to do something that I can be home more. And ended up going back into the furniture business with my family, which is had a furniture store here in Columbia. And then after that, I got hired into doing orthopedic implants because of my background.
Interesting.
Some of the guys I graduated with. Weird thing, I go to a convention just to keep up my continuing education units for athletic training, even though I wasn't working as one.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw some of the guys I used to work under and when I was a student. And a guy comes up and he says that I know, and he says, hey, are they hiring you for the job? I saw you talking to them. Well, I didn't even know what they were talking about.
Hmm.
So on the way home, I text Jeff and I said, hey, are you hiring somebody for some job? And he just says, yeah, do you want it? I'm like, I don't even know what it is. Hold up a second. So we met, we talked a little bit, and then I asked, I said, is the friend, I don't want to mention him, he's passed away now. I said, is he one of the candidates? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, I don't want to take a job from him. So if that doesn't work out, you let me know. So about 8 months later, they called me back, said, that's not working out. Do you want the job? And I said, yeah, I'll take the job. And so started doing orthopedic implants in Hattiesburg with Arthrex, a couple other small companies. Grew that 33% a year for 6 years.
Wow.
And then,
so was it like a sales role?
It's a sales role and a service role,
right,
at the same,
yeah,
time.
Did you like that?
I liked a lot of it. The pressure I did not like.
Yeah.
And for our folks that don't know, that are listening to the podcast, what is an orthopedic implant?
Any like total knees. I did mostly started out doing sports medicine stuff. So ACL reconstructions. I sold them the equipment that they use, teach them how to use our equipment, teach them how to drill the angles they're trying to do. I was kind of the guy that would sit in the surgery and he could tell me what he wanted to do, and I could tell him, this is what you can use to do what you want to do.
Okay.
And then we would sell them the implants that they put in or the tissue, metal.
That part sounds fun.
That part was fun because it fit into my
background.
That's
not the pressure part that you were talking about.
No, huh? The pressure part is your competitor sitting on the other side of the room looking at you trying to constantly sell his to the same guy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that was the pressure part.
Very competitive industry.
Yeah, and I wasn't used to that.
Yeah.
You know, I was used to being very in a tight-knit group. You know, everybody around me, we were close. We had been through a lot together. We supported each other. And all of a sudden, I go to this, and I'm by myself.
Surrounded
by wolves, but we're all eating lunch together.
Yeah.
You know,
and all smiling.
Yeah. You know, we're all eating lunch together. And somehow we all survive, but we're always trying to cut each other's throat. While we're talking to each other, and we all know it. And it was just a situation I wasn't used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I just at some point had to move on, to go do something different. And that's kind of how I got into what I'm in now, is the fact that selling biologics. Well, that's when biologics were first really coming into the medical space, like
and
PRPs.
You're defining biologics as well.
Protein-rich plasmas, where they were pulling blood, spinning it down, taking the plasma out, re-injecting it, different things like that. Injections for Brewster cone injections for the knees and different things like that. That was starting up pretty heavy, and I just had an interest to it. And I really had an interest to it not because I felt like I knew it, but I looked around and realized nobody else knew it.
Hmm.
And I didn't really have competition. So it was a really an easy flow for me to go from what I was doing to that, because it was a safe space for me.
Yeah.
Because once I knew if I could conquer biologics, I would be ahead of everybody.
Right.
And that made it was just a comfortable space for me.
Why was there no competition?
New.
Okay.
And complex.
So you know, were way ahead of the curve then?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, new and complex. And I mean, it's hard to come sell a doctor on something you're really not sure you can explain to him that it's worth the money.
Hmm.
You know, because there's not a lot of studies out there that shows it. There's not a lot of anything to support other than logic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a good background in medicine and orthopedics from athletic training, and I could come and talk to the guys and say, hey, you know, when these things happen and there's not an answer, why wouldn't this be the answer? And we could talk it out, and they would say, yeah, I like that. Let's give it a shot. And we'd start trying, and stuff would work. You know,
so in that situation, the physician feel more like a teammate instead of a customer you're
absolutely
trying to pitch to?
You were always a teammate.
Hmm.
You know, you're the only person in the surgery. You know, people don't realize orthopedic surgeons don't see other orthopedic surgeons work.
Hmm.
Why is that?
Because they're doing their own clinic. You know, an orthopedic surgeon, you can have 15 orthopedic group surgeons in your group. None of them watch the other one do anything. They're all hustling, doing their own thing while you're in surgery. And then when that guy's not in surgery, he's doing his thing and the other guy's in there doing surgery. They don't see each other. Huh. So when you have a medical rep, that medical rep is trying to help him correct things like some other guys have corrected it. And so you're kind of his eyes and ears to what's working or what's not working. And it just turns into a pretty good partnership.
And I'm assuming they're relying on you for industry updates and cutting-edge breakthroughs and so forth.
Yep.
Huh.
And so, you know, we would put on cadaver labs, and we'd go to cadaver labs, and they get to practice on a cadaver.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We did hundreds of those. Hundreds of them. Probably did 25 or 30 a year minimum.
So let's transition into what you're doing now. How is it? Obviously, you're in the biologic space. Tell us about what you're into now.
I sell drugs. I'm just kidding.
Well, are they good? That was a good interview.
Yeah, that's George, a great interview. Nice talking.
Hey, Zach, we're going to need to make some edits.
Zach. I don't even know who you are. But I'm in the biologic space now. I have a patent for stem cell production and introduction into the body. And that kind of came from that biologics background.
Okay.
So I started working with a group out of New York that has the other stem cell patent. His is direct sonication of vascular cells. Mine's indirect. And that's kind of how I ended up in this space.
So what are we treating with this type of therapy?
Well, our big thing right at the moment is autism.
Okay.
We're doing a lot of treatments with autism. We've probably...
People that took too much Tylenol?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Lord.
It's a meme right now. Hey. Lord. It's a meme right now. I'm sorry.
What's this guy's name again? Siri? No, yeah, something like that.
Something like that.
Well,
it's all it's been on my feed is people that took Tylenol.
Yeah, I know.
I'm about to blame my mom for my autism.
Yeah.
But to the spirit of Caleb's remark, I do have to say, man, autism is such a sensitive subject.
Oh,
man.
It's unbelievable.
How do you navigate that?
It's difficult. It's difficult. I'll be honest, my navigation first is claims. I don't want to get people in the listening area stirred up that we're making claims that we're curing autism.
Right.
I don't know that autism can be cured, because if it is a recessive gene that gets to rear itself when there is stress on the body, then you can possibly create a situation where that inflammation is gone because there's no reaction, and then you can push it back, kind of like having Parkinson's. You know, you can test positive for Parkinson's and not have any symptoms of Parkinson's because it hasn't expressed itself yet.
Okay.
Well, if you can reverse that back and repress that recessive gene, then the person with autism, kind of like with Parkinson's or ALS or anything like that, they can revert back to a situation where they can develop as they normally should have and end up in a situation where maybe they're not 100% normal, but they're 90 to 95% normal. And that person can exist very well in the U.S.
So it's really about a better quality of life.
It is absolutely about a better quality of life. But we've treated over 1,000 patients total, not just autism. We're probably at 115 autistic kids. We had to ask for some leeway with the state to do a study with them, which the state allowed. And we did 15 to 20 kids on a study, and we were hoping on a good factor that 20 to 40% of those kids would see a good result. I think we're at probably 95 to 100% of those kids have seen an impressive result. So,
can you say that number again, please? 90 to 95%
are seeing things that don't happen anywhere.
How is that being measured? Is that based upon what's being observed by doctors, parents, the whole team?
Mostly parent feedback.
Yeah, because they're the ones that are there every day.
They're the ones that are there. And autistic families are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. They are the smartest medically trained, self-trained people that exist. They know when you're telling them one little thing that's not in par, they sniff it out. They'll ask you questions over and over and over because they're not comfortable with something that doesn't fit with the realm of what they have studied and believe and know to be true and know to be possibly true. And so it is a group of people that you can't lie to.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a kid that comes in and 6 years old, nonverbal, has spoken one word that her entire life, can't sleep more than 2 hours, anxiety is out the roof, and you treat them and they come back 30 days later and the child's sitting in the mama's lap rubbing her face, calling her pretty, that changes a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it changes a lot.
That would definitely qualify as an improvement.
That is an improvement. What I have seen, and I do a lot of research into this, is the problem with autism is somewhat what the families call a success. And you're talking about a group of people who are looking for hope in anything. Mm-hmm. They've been told there's nothing you can do for your child. Your child's going to be like this even after you're gone.
Hopeless news.
Yeah, even after you're dead and gone, your child's going to be like this. So they're worried about leaving this world and who's going to take care of their child.
Mm.
That's
a scary spot.
That's where the fear for them is. That's their driving motivator. And so that's why they are relentless and they continue and continue and continue to try things is simply because they don't have an option.
Mm.
And so to back that up, what you run into is a parent treats a child with something, whatever it is, Lucorvin, whatever it is, and all of a sudden, if you'll notice, most autistic children don't scan the room. They just look down. They'll look at you and they'll look down. Well, they'll treat them and all of a sudden they're scanning the room. Well, they'll go, this is amazing. And it is amazing, but that's it. And so one other thing is another parent does something and they potty train for 2 days. And then they go back to normal and they say, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out of this hope. And so what happens is there's no way to grade what amazing is.
No.
You know, I can treat a child that is the child I was speaking of, 6 years old, nonverbal, had never looked her mother in the eyes at all, had severe anxiety, hadn't slept more than 2 hours. six weeks later, sleeping all night, no anxiety meds, speaking three word sentences, telling her mama how which way to go to Walmart. But if I say amazing, well, amazing is the same word everybody's using for every little thing they see. Yeah. And so the grading of what amazing is part of the problem.
There's a spectrum of that.
Correct. Yeah. That's part of the problem when grading what's out there and working. Everybody uses the word amazing because it's out of hope.
Yeah.
And so that's hopefully what we do next is create something that is here that we can collect data that's not based on the word amazing.
Because I'm assuming this is exacerbated by society where, especially in the context of medicine, we're used to going, well, there's a lab draw for that.
Yep.
You know, there's an XYZ machine that can tell you exactly what the number value is of progress.
Well, our medicine today is 85% diagnostics, 15% therapy.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You look across the board. We diagnose. And then we give you this option, which is either a medication or a therapy, sometimes surgery. Then we're back to therapy and medication after surgery. You know, so that's what our medical society is right now, is it's 85 to 90% diagnostics. And I'm in diagnostics. You know, I have a diagnostic, a lab that I make money on and make a living out of. So I understand. But the offer of therapy out there is really limited, you know, in all aspects.
Why is that?
That's a whole lot of story there. Yeah. I'm going to say limiting to insurance.
Oh, you know that's going to play a role.
Yeah, limiting the insurance.
To be honest, man, there's been a couple of times I've had to peek at the shot clock going, man, I feel like there could be a whole other podcast episode in and of itself. Because, I mean, yes. I don't even feel like we can get started about the role of insurance
on our
current healthcare system.
We cannot.
One thing that does come to mind, though, is, dude, help me understand the connection between orthopedics and stem cells. Like, did you just wake up one day and go, I want to get into stem cells and help – try to
I had this all planned out.
how did that transition work?
Well, orthopedics are very intelligent guys, and they can look at something and logically tell you if it's working or not. And it's kind of like they can do test and it comes back negative, and they can look and say test is wrong, because some things you can see and smell and you know what it is, even though the test comes back doesn't mean it's not there. So when stem cells started coming around, orthopedic surgeons are the first ones who really bought in stem cells. Well, I was working orthopedics. I've never met an orthopedic surgeon that doesn't believe in stem cells.
Really?
Ever. Any state, anywhere. The reason they don't use it more is hospitals won't reimburse for it.
Wow.
Once again,
an insurance issue.
Absolutely. They would use stem cells in every single surgery they had if they could use it for wound closures, whatever. I mean, they would use it on everything. And they are the pioneers, probably. If any medical group should get some praise for this actually coming into the U.S., it would have to be the orthopedic groups. So when we started down that path, we were looking for things for orthopedics.
Okay.
And doing orthopedic injections, different things like that. Well, as our product got better, we started realizing, hey, from Dr. Cole, he's an infusionist. He's like, why can't we infuse this into the bloodstream? I'm like, hey, I was wanting to just do a total knee, okay? You came out of left field with something. That's not my groove. Well, he's an infusionist, and he graduated out of Thomas Jefferson Medical out of Philadelphia, and that's what they do. And they only graduate 2 to 3 a year.
What?
There's not many.
And why is that?
I think it's because it's not a fun part of medicine.
Huh.
If you're infusing somebody, they're not in good health.
Mm.
You know, and it can be depressing, and most guys just can't mentally handle that kind of depression.
So in that line of work, there's a lot of end-of-life quality of life.
End-of-life is a lot.
Okay.
you know, nobody that's coming in and getting an infusion is running marathons, you know. And so it's just that part of medicine that those guys, it's not fun. Right. Gets depressing. And so we looked at everything, and I started talking with Dr. James Poser, who's probably the godfather of stem cell production in the U.S. He developed most of the programs, like what we've talked about, of amnion and placental captures and cord bloods and things like that. He probably developed most of those processes in the U.S.
Wow.
And so he would go to all these labs as they start this process and correct things they were doing wrong or help them fix things to get approvals. So we went through that, and Dr. Cole convinced us. We did everything James Poser told us we need to do for this to be infused in the bloodstream safely, and we started infusing it. The first ones we infused were actually for arthritis. And it just wipes it out. Wipes it out.
How quickly?
First infusion.
Okay.
Like, wipes it out. So we thought, man, we're on to something. You can't get people to come pay out-of-pocket money to get rid of arthritis. It's not enough pain. Well, insurance will pay for this treatment. We'll pay for that knee injection. We'll pay for this, pay for that. Long as insurance will pay for something else, they're just not going to come out of pocket for it. So then what we noticed is diabetes. It started wiping out diabetes for 8 months and 3 weeks. It was like clockwork. So everybody we treated, their diabetes would just go to 15% of the insulin they were taking or to none for about 8 months. And then it just start, about month seven, it just start creeping back up. Huh. If you treated them again, it'd go away. So then we were thinking, well, back on to something. So we're thinking, well, for insurance to ever approve this, it's got to get past 12 months for it to be effective. So how do you do that? Multiple infusions. Well, that's where the multiple infusions came from, was treating diabetes. So we said, how long should we wait? So we would wait 3 months, do two more treatments, make it 6 months worth of treatments. Well, now their diabetes is down past 12 months. Well, every insurance policy rotates every 20% of all insurance policies rotate every year, flip to a new policy. So if you can push this person into a new policy, insurance wins. So we're thinking that'll do it. Back to the same problem. Nobody wants to pay to cure diabetes. They're getting insulin, they're getting metformin, whatever they want. They don't have to come out of pocket. So they just stick with status quo. So here's where we finally found our niche is people with pain will pay.
Yeah.
And that's where we started finding where our future was going to be. And that is with people who have pain. So you got epilepsy, you got neuropathy, you know, cardiovascular diseases, traumatic brain injury, and autism. That's the group of people that either are in pain or concerned that their life has been shortened severely. Those people are the people who will come to us, and we see great benefits out of it.
But that's not just who this could benefit. It's just that that's kind of
that's
the target audience. Correct. That's going to be able to pay.
So we've been doing this 9 years now. We started, I want to say, in 2016. I think I was the first patient at the end of 2016. When it was kind of funny, I was in Houston, I was flying home, it was a Thursday, the girls said, hey, we got the product, it's the real deal. And I said, it's the real deal? I said, yeah, all right, well, I'm doing it in the morning. I'm like, wait, we didn't mean that. I said, no, you told me it's ready or it's not.
Huh.
And so one of the other surgeons said, I'm in, let's do it. So next morning, we went in and got our treatment.
Wow.
And that's when the story got interesting.
What were you getting treated for?
Well, that's where bullfighting comes in. Concussions.
Yeah.
I was having severe breakdowns. I was having concussion syndrome like you see on the movie. I mean, breaking down, crying, no reason.
Because of the way that it's affected the frontal lobe of the brain. Yeah.
It's like you have this horrible thought that starts, and you can't stop it.
Yeah.
and you want it to stop, and it won't stop, and it's just going horrible. People are dying. You can't stop them, all this stuff, and it just starts wearing you out. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, two or three times a day, you're just pulling off the side of the road, crying your eyes out because you don't know what's wrong.
Mm. And a lot of studies with people with concussions that have committed suicide.
Oh, I can see it without a doubt. Yeah. I got a friend of mine who committed suicide in January, I feel like I missed it. Yeah. You know, because he reached out to me about something else, but he said he was fine. And I feel like I should have seen it. But you're good at hiding it when you have that issue.
Yeah.
So I was wanting to see, we had done a test on me, an EEG, and I had lost 17% of my word recovery.
Wow.
And we knew that. Well, I had told Dr. Cole and another partner that what was happening with me. I had not told my wife, had not told anybody. I mean, I would break down crying driving my kids to school.
Yeah. And not even know where it came from or why or anything else.
Nope. And Dr. Cole said that it's your normal brain can say, it's not real, shut it off. But the injured brain cannot. It knows it's not real, but it can't shut it off.
Yeah.
And that's where the anxiety comes from, and it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Because, you know, we didn't bring this up when you were telling us about the bullfighting career, but I just kind of took it for granted. You probably got some meaningful injuries over the course of that. Huh?
Oh, yeah. I've had my teeth cracked. I've had everything.
Getting hit that hard.
Yeah. I got hit under the jaw one time, went completely over the rail into the stands. You know,
you took flight.
Oh, I took flight.
Wow.
Not the first time either.
Really?
But you know, when you close your jaws and your teeth are crunching in the back, that, and you're still out there fighting, by the way, I didn't go unconscious, but I did a couple of times and I didn't even know it.
Are you serious?
I saw, I remember stepping in front of a guy coming off a bull one day. The bull's name was Cinderella. And next thing you know, he cartwheels me. Well, he gets me across the ground, and he's rubbing me across the ground. I got my hand between his horns, and he's pushing me. And he finally gets up and goes off. I didn't think anything about it. About 2 weeks later, somebody shows me the video. When he cartwheeled me, hit me, and I hit the ground cold as a hammer.
Wow.
Bull went across the arena, came back, ran across me, didn't even stop, turned around and came back, got back on me, and that's when I woke up. And I don't even have a time lapse.
Even to this day?
No time lapse. I never remembered blacking out at all.
Hmm. Wow.
You know, so taking that into consideration, we knew I had scarring in my frontal lobe.
And had the EEG to prove
it. So I wanted to see if the scarring would go away. So I did that for that reason. Not thinking about it might fix the symptoms. I was just thinking if it could stop the scarring, I wouldn't get worse.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't happened since the first infusion. Not one bout of chronic depression or anything.
So you've been asymptomatic for how long now?
8 years.
From
one infusion.
Well, I can't say it's from one because I've had so many since, but I've never.
Okay.
Now, I have had where over time I can feel the word recovery going away, and I'll do another one.
Okay.
But I probably did one every 8 months for the last 8-9 years, but that's gone.
Wow. So now, here's the question, though. Have you had a follow-up EEG?
No.
That would be interesting.
That would be interesting.
Huh. So then it wasn't, so if I'm catching your story correctly, then it wasn't like you were doing orthopedics and you thought, okay, stem cells could help with this, this, and this, and this. You've just been discovering these things.
Discovering it as we go.
Which I got to say, man, so it's an interesting story arc because on the one hand, you're getting into the arena with 1,300 pounds of rage coming at you, and you're okay to do that not once but twice but for years on end. Let me tell you about a different arena that's equally as intimidating. You talk about autism and social media.
Yes.
In the age of misinformation.
Yes.
And stem cells in the age of misinformation. And you decide you're going to put them together.
It frustrates me.
How do you navigate that arena?
Lightly. You try to do it without telling people they're wrong. You know, but the big problem out right now in the world is the word stem cells.
Yeah. So I was even having this conversation earlier with somebody. I even know, I guess, from my history, it mostly from the fundamentalist Christian side, there was just this stigma of stem cells
killing
always,
babies.
That it's always coming from killing babies. So that address our audience on
absolutely
on this. Yeah, Joey, are you killing babies?
Not lately.
Hey, Zach, that was a joke. We're gonna have to edit that too.
Zach. But I like this guy. I've never even met him. It's very frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I see all the comments on social media is, well, we just got stem cell therapy. No, you didn't. Because the product you used was called cord blood. The product you used was called amnion. You know how I know? Because it was labeled that, because the FDA requires you to label what you're using. There is no product out there that has only stem cells in it. And I'm not even sure if that product would truly be effective. Because a stem cell only has one effect, and then it's gone. So, you know, it's kind of like throwing a piece of bread at a sandwich shop. You know, you got to have all the ingredients to make the sandwich to have something that's really usable, and that's not what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this stuff, I mean, one of the guys pulled up this company. There's a company in the U.S. that's literally processing stem cells and selling it out of the country because I can't sell it in the country. I can look at the product, and it's clear as water. I can tell you now there are no stem cells in that.
Yeah, that's not what he's claiming.
So the claims in the last 4 months have escalated. And it's used to you were getting 60 million stem cells. Then you were all of a sudden, oh, well, you're giving out 120 million stem cells. Now it's 250 million stem cells. Now this company's selling 530 million stem cells.
And is that because the argument in the public domain is more stem cells equals better results?
I think the argument has started from groups selling therapy. They're using numbers. And if you're not buying your product from the FDA, which nobody is, you can say whatever number you want.
Hmm.
There's nobody.
Because there's no regulation of it.
There's some companies out of the country that are registered with the FDA, and they announced they're FDA registered. So I had David, who works for me, used to run a tissue bank, pulls up all the registrations. They have no products listed. They're registered in the FDA. They don't have one product listed that's getting FDA oversight. But they're FDA-approved products because they're an FDA-registered company. But none of their products are registered with the FDA.
Hmm.
You know?
Wow.
And they act like that matters. Well, if you're going to Tijuana, the FDA doesn't regulate that.
Right.
They only regulate what comes here. So I don't find myself saying this often, but the FDA is right. They have guidelines that need to be followed for safety. And not just for safety, so the consumer knows what they're getting.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you're putting the stuff in your body.
Yeah, you're putting it in your body. Well, if you don't have an actual list and a test, a FDA-registered test with an FDA-registered clinician signing off that this is what is in this product, you have no proof what's in that product. And they don't. I can buy amnion, I can buy cord blood, I can buy anything I want, but it tells me what they submitted 6 years ago from one cc of how much is in this cc. It's a theoretical past proven point. And so I got to present some information so I can sell this bottle of amnion. Well, if it had 25,000 stem cells in it, by the way, they're all dead now because it's powder. You know, you've completely dried it out. You've killed every cell in it. Well, now there's not actually 25,000 stem cells in this bottle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where the misinformation is coming from. And that's difficult. You know, we're in a new age. You know, used to, and for 30 years, everybody always said, if you really want treatment, you got to go out of the country. You want to get real cancer treatment, you got to go out of the country. You know, you want this, you got to go out of the country because the FDA is not going to allow it. Well, we finally have a product that's in the U.S. that you can come to the U.S. to get that's better than everybody else's, and it follows under all the guidelines that the FDA put out for us to follow.
But now I could easily hear some of our listeners going, well, now, wait a second. He said he's not killing babies, but you keep using this word called Ambien.
Yeah.
So does that mean it's coming from the amniotic fluid?
Yeah.
And so how does that
and
work?
And Baptist Medical in Memphis started this. And so what it is, let's be clear, nobody's killing babies.
Okay.
It may be happening in China for something. It's not happening anywhere else because nobody's going to do that. You know, it's...
Well, we do kill some babies in this country, yes, but that's not what we're talking about.
Total different subject.
Totally different thing. So, but I think that's important that we address of like yes. Where this is getting harvested from.
Well, think about it this way. You right now have somewhere, if I averaged you with the American, you have about 150,000 stem cells floating in your bloodstream right now.
Okay. At any given moment.
Any given moment.
Right. Okay.
150 to 200. We'll say 150 is probably more realistic. Younger, it's a little bit higher. Older, it's a little bit less. And so all these things store in the fat. So when you hear Ambien.
I've got some of that.
Hey, we need donors.
I hear a business deal coming.
Hey, business deal.
Man, I'm up for opportunity.
How much was this drink? But so what you're looking at is Baptist Medical started this in Memphis probably 10 years ago. And what they did is they said, okay, we're going to harvest the placenta after childbirth. And they would pull that in, drop it into a bag. I went and watched this.
Mm-hmm.
They pull it into a bag and then take that bag and remove it from the scene, seal it up, and take it and ship it to a lab. Well, they test the mother for a blood test 2 to 3 weeks prior. Then they also tested the day of the childbirth. And that's the test they run to make sure that she doesn't have anything that can be passed on, some other type of agent. So then they take that and they pull the cord blood out of it. They pull most of the time that's chopping it, but then they pull what fluid they can out. But then they'll take the placenta and they completely put it in a blender and mince it up.
Huh.
And that's where Ambien comes from.
Interesting.
And they'll pull... You can't pull dried blood out, but if you can keep that cord clamped off enough, you can put a needle in, suck that cord blood out, and store it. And that's why people say they store cord blood for their kids. Well, the reason is that can be helpful, but you can only use it one time. And
why is that?
It's not enough.
Okay.
Just not enough. And is it effective? Yeah, but it's got white blood cells in it. It's got red blood cells in it. 1 to 2% of its stem cells. So the average harvest from a cord blood harvest is around 460 million stem cells or 460 million total cells. About 1.8 million of those are stem cells.
Okay.
The rest is red and white. But that's why the FDA worries about rejection because you have white blood cells in that product. If you're a family member, there's only 6 markers on the cell that the body can detect whether it wants to reject something or not. Well, if you get 50% from your mother and 50% from your father, you're harvesting the cord blood from the mother. Well, if you match 25% of those markers, you're considered a match.
Okay.
Without rejection. Well, you know you got 50% from the mother. So we don't have to test that. But if you haven't, if it's from a donor, well, you have to do what's called a HLA test, compatibility test, to show how many of those markers you actually have to determine if you can accept that cord blood or not without having a rejection. The cool thing about true stem cells, which we collect out of perivascular fluid in the fat, we don't like the fat, but there's cells in the perivascular fluid around the minute capillaries that is loaded with stem cells.
And what do you mean by perivascular? It's like, where is that on the body?
It's in all the fat of the body.
Okay.
You typically abdomen, low back, thighs. So that fluid that's in the fat is perivascular fluid. And that's a term that's in my patent. That's one of the terms I produced.
So if I'm following all this correctly, and for our listeners, even if you were using amniotic fluid, cord blood, et cetera, it's not from aborted babies.
No.
But you're saying you don't even use that anyway.
No,
you're pulling fat of an adult.
Yep.
Like the body fat of an adult.
I would prefer a 25 to 35-year-old person for a donor.
Okay.
And just because there's that's kind of the peak of the body where it's like a good age for the average that your stem cells have peaked, but you have just enough fat. You haven't got into the 40 and 50-year-old abdomen fat, and it's a good age. And so we do know younger is better.
Mm-hmm.
So that fits extremely well.
And when the lay audience hears pulling fat off of an adult, we think of liposuction.
It's very similar.
It is?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, very similar. Difference is they use 5-millimeter cannulas, which is a long stick that's 5 millimeters in diameter. We use smaller ones that are about a third that size, maybe even less, and they're very flexible. And so we don't want to collect the fat. We just want to collect the fluid, which is part of our design. And so you're not dealing with aborted babies. I don't think anybody can use a placenta off aborted baby, by the way. I don't think that's allowed. So to say that, I'm not saying amnion and cord blood are bad, but they're not enough in them to have a systemic effect for an extended amount of time. That's the problem you run into. And the FDA doesn't allow you to say that live stem cells are better than dead. Whether we believe it or not, we can't make that claim.
Huh.
So there is some anti-inflammatory effect from amnion, which is a dead stem cell being injected into your joint, but it's not going to keep you from needing a total knee. You know, it might help with your pain for a couple of months, and it may not. But it's not going to offset a total knee. You know, it'll extend it from having to get the total knee. But I would venture to say that probably happens 25% of the time.
So we talk about getting to these touchy arenas. All right. So you now have navigated the I'm not killing babies part.
Yep.
All right. But let's talk about the other part of the arena, and that's autism.
And
to make that even more complicated, oh, by the way, you're talking about my child's autism.
Correct.
So, man, how do you navigate that? I mean, parents are going to have all kinds of questions, and you're talking about fear, and they don't want to be taken advantage of. I mean, that's a lot to navigate.
Yeah, and I don't know you can navigate it other than just answer their questions and be direct.
Really?
Because, like I said, they are so well-versed, they know if you're putting a little line on them or not. You know, they've heard it all. They've seen it all.
Probably been taken advantage of.
Matter of fact, three of the kids that have told us their result of their autism, which is by a third party that we never met, they all had been overseas in other countries and done other treatments and done other things. And when they came to us, they said, we're just giving this a shot. Because we've been everywhere.
Mm.
And then it worked. And then it's when you realize we really are onto something because these people came and told us everything. One kid had been out of the country four times. They'd spent over $125,000. Said never saw any results.
This kind of gets to what Caleb was talking about, though, about hope.
Yep.
I mean, because that's... I would assume that you've probably been accused of selling hope, which is not what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, truth be told, man, you're dealing in such a dangerous water. You've probably been accused of all kinds of things.
I've been accused of all kinds of stuff.
And so how...
Most of it not nice.
How do you talk to a terrified parent that's probably hopeless and say, hey... You know, we have something that could help, but we can't guarantee anything.
Yeah.
You know,
I think we say exactly that.
Really?
You know, most of these families that come to us already are looking for some type of cell therapy.
Yeah.
You know, they have been looking into it. And the problem is going to Panama for $25,000 for one infusion, not everybody can do that. Because that's not the flights down there. That's not taking the family, because it takes more than one parent to take an autistic child to Panama. And that's not the stay. That's just one infusion.
Okay, well, then let me play devil's advocate. So take that family that you said had five infusions, $125,000 that they're out in Panama.
With no results.
With no results. Yeah, so Caleb probably knows where I'm about to go with this. If I'm already out over $100,000, how are you even going to help me believe that you can offer anything different, because you're still saying stem cells too?
I can offer them this great drink that Caleb just gave me and just say, here's the truth. We don't know if it's going to help or not, but we think it will. And this is what we've been seeing. And that's that.
So I guess I'll package my question a different way. How do you build credibility when there are so many different things working against you in the public domain?
You refer them to patients that we've treated.
That have been through, yeah.
And that are okay with
it. And that is huge.
Really?
Yeah.
We've had patients call and will not even ask, won't even let us talk to them. They just, what's the deposit? We're like, we know really? You talked to somebody. Who is it? And they'll say, we just need to get on the books. What's the deposit?
So you're saying you've had some past patients that are okay sharing their story and sharing their medical
information. That's where we get all our patients right now.
Really?
Yep. This is such a tight group of people. You know, these kids,
they usually know each other.
Well,
because they got a strong.
Yeah, and you think about it, community. What happens is all of a sudden their kids have been playing together for 2 years, and all of a sudden Johnny is walking over asking questions.
Yeah.
And has never asked questions before. And in the beginning, we asked parents not to tell anybody because of the big powers to be and, you know, big things out there that like to stop things. We didn't want to tell anybody. And I'm going to give them a lot of credit. They're as scared that somebody's going to take this away as we were.
Really?
So they wouldn't tell anybody. They wouldn't tell their teachers. They wouldn't tell their friends. They didn't even tell a lot of their family.
I've noticed on your website, too, you're having it makes sense as to why you're having to protect that anonymity of that,
yes,
of that source.
Yes.
Because, I mean, there's HIPAA, obviously. But if you've got patients saying, I want to tell people because of the impact it's had, that's amazing. I mean, like, that's better than any marketing campaign you could ever have.
Look, I can't get family to talk good about me. Getting those people to do it. Like, hey, I want to tell everybody.
But to your other point, though, if this is a situation where I've seen you're, like, no kidding, helping my child, and I think there's a 1% chance that a big government could take this away, I'm not telling a soul.
Yep.
Sorry. You're talking about my kid. I mean,
when we did that study with the 20 parents, it was 15 to 20, we asked them not to tell anybody. Teachers started asking, what's going on?
The teachers.
And to me, that was our biggest advocate, is the teachers union, because we never met those people and they are trained to deal with these children. Well, when the teachers everywhere are coming back wanting to know what's going on with Johnny, because now he can sit in class, he's not having outburst, he's starting to be able to take some of the test, different things, and the parents go, oh, nothing. And you're like, and so what happened is some of the friends just finally said, hey, what are you doing? Because our kids aren't the same anymore, and you said we're friends.
Wow.
That's what happened. And all of a sudden, we started getting the referrals. So the 115 we've treated, I would say probably 80 of them came from referrals from the first 20.
Wow.
Mm-hmm, 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
So a fourfold return. Absolutely. On referrals.
Absolutely.
And that does that speak,
all referrals.
Does that speak just to all the autism community and how tight-knit it is?
It speaks to a lot. It speaks to, one, when they told people they came with ready to do this. You know, I mean, so they represented it. They represented us probably better than we could have represented ourselves. But they're tight-niched. it's kind of like Mike that's going to come to help run the company. We treated his child and his wife, and he's wanting to leave the military to come run this because he believes in it.
Just because of the impact it had on his family.
Just because the impact it had on his family. And he said, Jory, you got to realize all these kids go to ABA therapy. They go to some type of voice therapy. They go to some type of psychotherapy with the family to try to help teach you how to deal with the child. And you're sitting in waiting rooms and groups. You get to know each other. You start texting and helping each other. And he's like, you get one person in that class, by the time little Johnny's increase over 60 days is so noticeable, everybody in there is calling wanting to know what's going on. And now what we don't want to do is come in and say, okay, I know your physician told you there's nothing that can be done. Well, he's wrong. Well, now you've stepped over a line with these families because they get mad at the physician at first for telling them that there's nothing you can do for your child. But over time, they start realizing that he's the only advocate they got because he told them the truth.
And now you're talking bad about my doctor.
Now you're talking bad about my doctor. So what we've had to do is reverse that and come in and say, when your doctor told you that, he was right. Okay. Now we have some options that weren't available then. Mm. And so that's the direction we're trying to go in. You saw the website. We've got the website where it's comfortable. It feels good. But now we're putting in the science.
Yeah.
Which is Dr. Cole making statements, me making a few statements. But now our next move is to put that scientific data in there that kind of says that. This is new. It's in the U.S. Your best product is in the U.S. It is FDA regulated. It is under FDA guidance. It is following the rules of the FDA. And yeah, it's not 250 million stem cells, but it is probably 60 million stem cells. But look at the effect.
And oh, by the way, here are the names and numbers of actual patients that are willing to share what's happening.
Here are the names and numbers. So Julie School over in Laurel, she just put together. The Knox Academy, she's on board with us. And I think we're going to give a 25% discount to all the families that she has selected for them to come to her school. And simply because Julie gets it.
And is this a special needs school or what?
It's an autism school.
Okay.
And it's one of the first, it's the first one inside of three or four states that I know of. And it's really good stuff that she's doing.
Have y'all treated anything maybe that's trying to figure out how to frame this?
So ignorance?
Maybe the people that have children that are maybe not, it's not autism, maybe they're like gene deletion.
Yeah.
Like say similar to Down syndrome and or chromosome, different gene deletion. Is there any hope there?
There's some. We've treated some pandas, and there's some autistic kids that have pandas, and we've treated four or five kids with pandas.
Mm-hmm.
So we have treated those. We have seen a lot of success with it. But again, I don't know enough about pandas to tell you I know what success is for pandas.
Right.
I get the feeling.
Like what the baseline.
Right. I get the feeling there's nothing that works. And so what we have seen is a reduction in anxiety and an increase in comprehension of talking. So I give you an example. And another thing, the ones that we treated with pandas, except for two or one, were over 20. I do think there's a change in the effect past 20 to 22 years of age. Especially with autism. I think after that, the effects are much slower and may be more limiting after that. And I think that's because you're getting out of the growth phase. So the body can't catch up and repair things that should have been repaired or should have been built in the beginning, according to your DNA. At some point, the body, it's kind of like a stroke. We can treat strokes real early. Unbelievable success. You wait and they've had that stroke 20 years ago, not much. Because the body does have a reset of a baseline. At some point, the body starts cutting off in slices of what used to be. And this is the new reality. And so I say that on the pandas that when we treated the older, we had a kid, I think he was 27, in New Orleans. We got a clinic in New Orleans that's been with us since day one. And he said the kid comes in, you know, kind of like lockdown, head down, not making eye contact, doesn't speak. He came back 30 days later, and he was sitting there, and the mother walked out of the room, and the kid was looking at a box of donuts. And the doctor walked in and looked at him and said, "Hey, you want a donut?" And said he looked down the hall to see where his mother was. And he says, "You can have a donut." And said he reached over and grabbed the donut, took a bite, and stuck it in his shirt.
Huh.
Never done anything like that before.
Hmm.
So, you know, yeah, but here's what I think stem cells is. I think stem cells is a major anti-inflammatory. I don't think it regrows new tissue. Not what we do. I don't think mesenchymal stem cells do that. I think it literally just wipes away the inflammation and your body can heal. The older you are, the slower the healing is. The younger you are, the faster the healing is. Which, in logic of theory, would say, well, then there's more to recover at the young age than there is at the older age. Because anything that's slower, you're going to be limited on the recovery at some point on the averages. Anything that's faster is going to have a higher ceiling. And so I just feel like that's kind of where we're at, is when you're young, you heal quick. The older you are, you heal slower.
Right.
And I think it's simply just wiping out the inflammation. And typically in these conditions we're talking about conditions that are neurological, they're in the brain.
Yeah.
And medications won't get there. The body doesn't allow it. Well, stem cells or cell therapy, the body allows it to go to the brain, which is something that, you know, Tylenol and Aleve and Midol and all these different things can't get to the actual brain. It just subsides the symptoms until the brain heals itself.
So a lot of people with autism, and they'll have these comorbid things from a mental, whether it's like OCD, bipolar. What about treating people that have those mental health conditions, like bipolar? Have you seen success with that? Is there?
I don't know that we've treated somebody bipolar.
Okay.
Anxiety. Yeah, we've treated ALS. I hate to tell this story because I don't think two people is a true dedication to medication.
But ALS, this is Lou Gehrig's disease. Yeah, this is a serious.
We've treated two people with Lou Gehrig's disease. The first guy we treated with three infusions. He probably wouldn't have made it 6 months. He came in, he was drinking through a straw. He came in the second infusion, which was 8 weeks later, and was eating a Subway sandwich. That's a fact.
Okay.
The second guy, then he quit treatment, and 2 years later passed away. Don't know why he didn't continue the treatments. The second guy, we were treating him, and he came in a wheelchair, lethargic, hard to speak, blah, blah, blah. He came back in 8 weeks later and said he fell off his front porch. So we asked him, you know, what were you doing? He said, "I was mowing my grass with my push mower." And he walked up.
He was wheelchair bound.
Yes. And he turned around and walked up the steps and turned around to grab the rail and missed the rail and fell down the steps on the ground. He completely reverted back to pre-diagnosis symptoms. Completely. He wanted to invest in the company, and I laughed and told him that ever happened, I'd let him know. But he passed away with a heart condition after that. Not long after that, actually. He had I think they said he had several clogged arteries in his heart that he didn't know about. And he, like I say, passed away. But that was within 6 months of us being done treating him. But like I say, those are the two we treated. I want to treat more, but it's really hard to get to these people time to treat them.
Right.
And it seems like it's extremely effective. But everybody you hear that has ALS is a superstar or some athlete or something, and to get to them in time through all their agents and all this mess, you can't get to them. Mm. And that's the only reason we hadn't treated more. I'd love to treat LS. From the two people we treated, which again, I want that well known because I don't think that's
a data point of two.
A data point of two is not really data.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it was effective with both. So, and to the effect that it was effective, why wouldn't we want to try more of it?
So you made the comment about Tom. I know we've kept you way past what we said we were going to, and I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a follow up.
This is so interesting, man. But one thing I do want to say, the majority of our community are small business owners.
Yeah.
And so I've got to represent them and ask at least one small business question for this. And I would say your story has made it abundantly clear that you don't mind working on hard things that don't have an easy path in the public sphere. So for our other small business owners out there listening to this episode that are trying to navigate an industry that's saturated with misinformation.
Yeah.
What's your advice to them? Because I'm sure you've taken more than a few punches. So do you have any advice for entrepreneurs who are trying to do something that's hard from a stigma perspective?
I think you got to be certain your avenue that makes you a little bit different and be recognizable. You know, if you're just the same thing that's out there, then you're just the same thing. You gotta be self-aware of where the rabbit holes not to chase.
Huh. I think otherwise you're just more noise.
You're just more noise. And I think you really got to sit down and maybe with help from others who've been successful, is sit down and say, you know, here's my vision, here's my path, correct me on it. And let people correct you without getting your feelings hurt. Mm. And then sit down and decide, okay, I'm going to stick to this path because this is who we are. And you just got to believe it. I mean, we preached on it this morning at the church. You just got to believe it. Yeah. You know, and the minute you quit believing it, what's the old saying? If you believe you can or if you believe you can't.
Either way, you're right.
Either way, you're right. You know? And so I think that's just the key in general. You just got to know who you are and be certain that there's a path for you that makes sense. But I say this probably in the closing of this statement. I've never known anybody to get to success by themselves. Mm. Yeah. And I think that's a big misconception in this world, is that wealthy people are there to beat you down and to keep you from being successful. And I have not found that.
Amen.
I have found that wealthy people, if they think you're sincere, will give you all the advice you want, but they're always going to give you the advice you don't want to hear because that's what matters.
Matter of fact, we had a recent episode where the whole thing was about hard truths.
Yeah.
You know, and they're very valuable if you can take them.
Yeah, and you got to take them. I mean, you either take it from them or you're going to take it from the world.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just think that's the misconception. And, you know, I haven't had my issues with the wealthy people I've gone to for advice. I've had my issues with wealthy people that I tried to partner with in the wrong way. Wow. That's where my issues always ran from.
Well, speaking of misconception, for the people that have a family member that's suffering through any of the number of things we've talked about, and they're willing to hear you out, to try to cut past the noise and the misconceptions, how best do they contact you or your company?
The best way is go to the website.
And what's that?
www.neurofree.com, which it's got a space between neuro and free.
NEURO-FREE.
Correct.
Correct.
All right. And there's a contact form on there. That contact form goes to all of the managers in the company, including myself.
That are willing to have a conversation.
That are willing to have a conversation. Doesn't matter if it's about autism or not. There are other websites coming in the next 60 days, but they're all going to come to the same people. And you just go to that website, go fill out that contact form and put in the information, what you're asking about, and somebody will call you. Okay. And it's free. There's consultations free. We're not charging anybody to call and have a conversation.
Okay.
Awesome. Man, Jory, thanks for coming, man.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Quality. Well,
Jory, I'm going to go ahead and pray for us and pray for Absolutely. You and pray for your company. And, yeah, so let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you, Jory, for his time, Lord. Thank you for what you've done for him and his life and how you've given him a heart to help people and to help families. And it's such a blessing that there's still people like Jory that you're pouring into and into this world. We thank you so much for this community that he is speaking to. Lord, we pray that it bears fruit in Jory's life and his business, and we lift up his family to you. Lord, we also lift up our community, everybody that's out there that's been faithful listeners to us. Lord, we thank them. Thank you for them so much. Lord, we, as always, ask to thank you for loving us and continue to teach us how to love you better. In your holy name we pray, Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
Are you intrigued by today's discussion? Want to hear some more? Great. Stay tuned because you can listen to any episode of the Sippy Podcast with Chris and Caleb by going to sippypodcast.com. That's sippipodcast.com. Or maybe you'd like to give us some feedback or share some thoughts that piqued your interest during our discussion. If so, that's even better. Send us an email to feedback@sippypodcast.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and have a blessed day.